like a tramp, like a video vamp. Demolition woman, can I feel, man? Hey everyone, this is Liberty Bells Radio. I'm Leah.
And I'm Allie.
And we're here today to talk about an exciting week we had last week.
Mrs. U! Woo!
College!
Yeah! Actual smart people.
Right, exactly. Well, a few dumb ones, I think.
Well, proportionately intelligent.
I agree with that statement. So yeah, Mises U was last week. Mises University, for those not in the know, it's at the Von Mises Institute. Are you seeing a trend here? Every year it's a week.
Yeah.
There are a lot of college kids, a lot of other kids, people from other countries here. We interviewed those Australians last week. If you missed that podcast, you should listen because it was great. We interviewed our friend Bob Murphy.
He was all right.
He was okay. He's a nice guy.
You could probably just skip that part.
I'm not really sure why he was even here. Oh, well. Anyway, that's what we did. The week was incredible, though, right?
Right. It was pretty exciting. It was nice because we got to experience Mises U without having to sit through any lectures, you know? We got the dumbed-down version, the layman's terms version.
We got the cliff notes.
Yeah, we got the cliff notes, exactly.
Although next year I think I want to go to Mises U.
That'd be cool.
And I think next year...
I'll just hang out at your house while you're there, and then when you get home, start partying. Start the party at our house.
The parties were great. We had a party at our house. We went out a bunch. Flyby Radio, which is kind of a local band, but they just do really good covers. Played for all of Mises U. 250 ANCAPs, Anarcho-Capitalist Voluntarius, and then the rest were college kids that go to Auburn were in the bar watching the band, not to mention a lot of the scholars, Hans Hoppe, Joe Salerno, Tom Woods, they were all there as well. It was mm-hmm. great.
There's a lot of big names, and it was interesting to go to the bar in Auburn that's kind of the
sorority, fraternity,
fraternity bar, the bar you go to when you don't plan on having any intellectual conversations whatsoever, and then, like, all the people you look up to intellectually are just kind of standing there. They've got their little nerdy Mises U shirts on.
They were all wearing the same shirt.
You come up to them and you're like trying to dance with the philosophers. It's kind of fun.
Yeah.
It's like you're on our turf now.
To give you guys an idea, the bar in Auburn where let's say one day you woke up and you said, I think I want to get roofied today.
Mm-hmm.
Then you would just go to that bar.
But that's not why they picked it.
No,
they
picked it because they don't want to roofie anyone, but it's not even the bar.
It's a really good venue, like it's like all open and everything. It's plenty of space. They have a good stage.
Well, it's huge.
It's huge. Yeah. So.
I mean, it's a smart pick, but when Mises U isn't there, that's
right. It's where everybody in Auburn wants to go, so it ends up being populated by what the majority of Auburnites are, which is kind of disappointing.
College kids.
Right.
Speaking of all those people, because of Mises U, we were lucky enough to score an interview with Dr. Tom Woods.
Yes, I was really nervous about this, but I think it went great.
Yeah, it did. And we recorded the interview, I believe, we recorded it last week, so you'll hear mention of his birthday, but his birthday is old news. It already happened.
Yeah, it already happened. He's old.
Yeah, older.
Older than he was.
That's right.
Well, only by like a week, but now it counts for more.
Exactly. So that happened, and we're going to just go ahead and play the interview for the podcast, and hope you guys enjoy it. If you have any questions or want to talk to us, libertybellsradio@gmail.com, and we'd love your feedback.
And also, give us more ideas for people we should interview.
That's right. I will say we have the opportunity, because we live in Auburn, to interview a lot of people that others are interested in. I mean, we interviewed Tom Woods, we interviewed Bob Murphy. There are other people who are here consistently that we could probably interview if we wanted to. So if you guys have any ideas of who you'd like to hear and what you'd like to hear about them, then we'd like to hear it too. Because I really like getting kind of the backstory on people. I mean, mm-hmm. we hear people talk about economics and...
We should interview Ron Paul.
Oh, we should interview Ron Paul.
I'm not making any promises, but that's our goal.
Ron Paul or
when
Lady Gaga.
When we interview Ron Paul, I will get a Liberty Bells tattoo.
I'll do it.
Mark my words. It's going to be on our podcast, so.
Okay. I'll do the tattoo.
Sweet.
All right. Okay, so without further ado, here you go. We actually have a special guest, Tom Woods, economist, historian,
New York Times bestseller and author, bestselling author, and also scholar at the Von Mises Institute. Thanks for being here.
My pleasure.
Actually, before we do anything, I found out that I think Monday is your birthday.
Yeah, it is. Yeah.
So happy, early happy birthday.
Thanks. Yeah. Do you want to ask how old I'm going to be?
I already know, but you can tell us.
You know, how do you know how old I'm going to be?
I Wikipedia'd it.
Oh, darn it. Yeah, I'm going to be 39. So it's the last good birthday until you're just depressed constantly until you're dead.
Yeah, and how does Heather feel about this?
Well, she's always making fun of my age. I'm an old man, whatever. But she's actually been very sweet as I approach 40, and I get very melancholy, and because I'm an extremely sentimental person.
About your
30s? Now that I'm 40, all these, you know, everything's behind me and whatever. But she's actually been a very helpful, good sport about it.
But it's not. I mean, it's not like it used to be. We're all going to live longer, so really 40 is the new 30.
Oh, that's right. Yeah. We're all living longer, and I'm going to have my head cut off and cryogenically preserved. So,
like Walt Disney.
Yeah, so we'll see.
Well, I actually asked the interwebs people, your fans, kind of what they wanted to know, and a lot of people were really interested in kind of knowing the backstory of how you came to Liberty.
Ah, well, I kind of told a little bit of that story in a talk I just gave here tonight at the Mises Institute.
Okay.
About, you know, how the long and the short of it is, I had the coolest father of all my friends. I mean, you take the cool factor of their fathers, put them all together, it couldn't even come close to mine. Because first of all, I had a young father. Like, my parents had me when they were like 20 or 21. So by the time I was graduating high school, my father was younger than I am now, with a high school graduating kid. So he would wear a jean jacket and not look totally stupid. You know, like, if you're like, when you're 60, you just can't do that anymore, right? But he, you know, he listened to Def Leppard, like he listened to all these 80s bands. I mean, this was just cool. Like, how could I? I can't believe I had this father. So, like, right away, I thought, I got the coolest father. I'm sure everything he believes is right. So then he started explaining to me about taxes and jobs and the government and all the ways it screws things up and how bad the commies are, and yeah, right, man, this guy's awesome, man, yeah. So that really sort of got me going in this way of thinking, but then in terms of really solidifying it and making it into a systematic way of thinking, I got to college, and I felt like I was surrounded by complete lunatics because I lived in Cambridge, Massachusetts.
At Harvard.
So you just walk around Cambridge, Massachusetts, just nutcases and, I mean, literal communists advocating for the values of the Bolshevik Revolution. It's just insane. And I just began to think that these people are so wrong that I want to be the opposite of what they are. And I started getting interested in libertarian ideas. And I went to this here event, this very Mises University event in 1993. And I read and I got to meet all these people. And I just was convinced that this was correct. I've been convinced of it just intellectually. It resonated with me. I believed it to be true. And plus, the people who conveyed it to me seemed like the neatest people in the world. And a lot of them were the same faculty who were here this time. But in those days, I didn't know them on a first-name basis. So Hans Hoppe just scared the heck out of me.
It scares me.
Yeah, but see, whereas now I feel like I can go up to him, "Hey, Hans, how you doing?" Yeah. "Oh, yes, it's good to see you." Yes.
How did you get in that position where you're friends with him?
Well, you know, once you get your PhD, I mean, I became an adjunct scholar of the Institute, and then 5 years ago I became a senior faculty member, partly because I was down here as a resident fellow, so I guess they figured, well, to justify having you down here, we better bump you up a little bit. But I think it was just a matter of, once I was on the other side of things, like I was publishing books too, and I was lecturing too, then I would get invited to the faculty dinners and things, and so I could shoot the breeze and, you know, play it cool, like,
enjoy
the
perks.
Of course I'm one of you guys, sure, whatever. But, and then I remember, I don't know why I want to tell this story, but...
Please do.
The one extravagance that I allowed myself after my Politically Incorrect Guide to American History did pretty well. And by the way, I hasten to point out, I wrote an article for LouRockwell.com some time ago that authors do not make nearly, not even one-tenth the money you think they make, okay? They don't sell nearly as many books as you think they do, even if they're bestsellers, and they make pennies. Okay, but I did pretty well with the Politically Incorrect Guide to American History, so I went out and bought a new BMW. Like, that was, and I just thought, oh, this is neat, right? You know, look, I got a cool car. That's great. You know, I worked my tail off. I'm going to enjoy this car.
Mm-hmm.
So anyway, there was a, I don't want to mention names, but there was a scholar who gave me kind of a hard time about the Politically Incorrect Guide. So Hans, who had just seen my new car at the dinner, has said, well, you should just say to him, what kind of car do you drive?
Did you ask him?
No, I thought, no, that's too cool to use. But also, I felt bad, and I'm not going to do that. The car is allowing me so much show-offiness, I don't need to milk it that much.
Do you get a lot of, because I've read a little of the Politically Incorrect Guide to American History, and it just flies in the face of everything I've ever been told. And you must, I mean, do you get, like, angry mail all the time? I mean...
Oh, yeah. Well, most of the time not, just because most people who are going to disagree with me are just not inclined to read a book with that kind of title in the first place. Once in a while, I do get it's extremely rare, actually. I do get an angry note from some guy who thinks I left out one event that he thinks is the critical event. The key to all of you is, like, every crank knows that has one critical event. If you don't mention it, you're a terrible historian. But that book had to be 80,000 words. That was the limit. So you have no idea how fast that goes by. So I initially wrote 100,000 words, and I thought, well, they're not going to complain. I'm giving them 20,000 free words. Complain they did. And in fact, they cut until they got it all the way back down to 80,000. They didn't, because they wanted the book to be of an accessible length so that people would pick it up off the shelf and read it. So, yeah, but when it came out, I did get attacked in the New York Times. I got attacked in the Boston Globe. So all the typical mainstream outlets, like, they think they're hurting me. But, of course, that gives me all kinds of street cred. People say, yeah, good, I would want the New York Times to be out. I wouldn't want the New York Times to like your book. And there were some neoconservatives and even some kind of wimpy libertarians who were, you know, carping
racist.
Sort of critics.
It came out in 2004?
Four, yeah.
Yeah.
But by and large, it actually was very well received. I got some very nice reviews. And probably the coolest thing that happened that by the end of that year was... if you ever watched the McLaughlin Group, it's John McLaughlin has these four guests, and they talk about politics and the events of the week. And at the end of the year, he has the year-end wrap-up show where they give out they're not real awards, but they'll have something like, you know, best political comeback, and like the politician you thought was gone forever, who made the best comeback, or you know, who had the best idea of the year, or whatever. And so they had the category Most Original Thinker of the Year.
Mm-hmm.
And when it came to Pat Buchanan, he said, I'm going to give it to Tom Woods.
Wow.
Well, if you feel free to do that, my friend, thank you.
That's
nice.
Great.
Yeah, that was nice.
We've seen you at MisesU, and everyone comes and talks to you about economics and wants to talk to you about all of your experiences and knowledge. But out of curiosity, if you could not be an economist or a writer, what would you do?
The first thing I wanted to be was a math teacher. Isn't that dorky? I wanted to be a high school
math
teacher.
More dorky than an economist?
Well, I think so. I mean, math. Math is just completely abstract. Economics, at least, you feel like has something to do with your daily lives.
When did you get into history?
That was another story. But basically, it was just when I went to college and I started dealing with all these crazy people I had to debate all the time, I found myself reading history to help improve my arguments. And I found history more and more interesting, and I began to think that I really want to be engaged in the world of ideas. And so if I become a historian, I can do that. But if I become a mathematician, would I ever have the time? It just wouldn't really work. You know, I couldn't do it as part of my profession. But, yeah, I actually would, because I was on the math team in high school.
You were a mathlete.
You're darn right I was. I was the co-captain 2 years running. I was on the Eastern Massachusetts All-Star Math Team. We had a national competition at Penn State. I was there 2 years in a row. I mean, you know, so what else was
impressive.
I going to be other than a math teacher?
So if this doesn't work out, you can always fall back.
You can always fall back on, yeah. There are many levels of dorkiness to who I am that I can always fall back on.
And I think it's funny because whenever Allie or I say dork or nerd, we always mean that as a compliment. We say that all the time, and then people look at us. No, we're complimenting
them. Yeah. No, that's the best thing it could be, right?
Okay. I also have a question about Ron Paul.
Okay.
If you got to pick his VP, who would it be?
Oh, that's really tricky. I mean, on the one hand, you want to pick a carbon copy of him. On the other hand, every political strategist would say that's not what you want. You want to pick somebody who's going to get you votes, who's mm-hmm. going to get you something that the candidate at the head of the ticket can't get for you. Mm-hmm. So that would mean you'd have to pick some rotten jerk. So, you know, great guy, rotten jerk. Like, how do you... So, I just don't know. I mean... if it was just a matter of who would be the best person, like, right? If all we care about is spreading the message,
right?
I don't care about if he gets a lot of votes, all the better. But you know, I've thought that Judge Napolitano would be a good one, just because he's a fiery speaker, he's pretty knowledgeable, he's reliable, he's totally in our corner,
mm-hmm.
and he can speak in a way that resonates with that Fox News crowd.
That's true.
Now, you know, like those people or don't like them, they vote, and they will listen to him because he's charming. He wins them over.
He's very charming.
And then he says to them, but you can't support the Patriot Act, and here's why. And then, you know, and so then they feel like, well, he's our friend. So if he tells me there's something wrong with the Patriot Act, I'm going to have to look at it.
Right.
So he's got that skill. So I've been joking with him for years that he should run for president in 2016.
Do you think he ever would?
I don't think so, because I think now that I didn't realize at that time that how obvious it was that Rand was going to run. And I don't think he'd want to go head to head in terms of trying to fundraise and everything with Rand. But I would joke with him about this, and, you know, but he would never actually outright say, I would never even consider it. But
To achieve the ideal, meeting an ideal of a society, do you think it's more effective to advocate political action, or more effective to do some things more like agorism, or things like that?
Over the past 18 months, I've become much more interested in agorism, and sympathetic to it. I mean, I didn't even really, you know, I'm embarrassed to say this, but I didn't even really know what it was until I kept finding it showing up in the philosophical descriptions of my Facebook friends, and I thought, okay. This is just ridiculous. Like, how are these people getting ahead of me with ideas? Like, aren't I supposed to know this stuff? What is this thing? So I started reading about it. I mean, I do think that there is some merit to that, and I think we can't even really know how successful it is because, you know, by definition, a lot of it's being done under the radar.
Mm-hmm.
But, and I think the underground economy is also much bigger than people think. There have been estimates that it's $1.5 trillion. I mean, it's very substantial. But at the same time, you know, Rothbard used to say that he would not take the dogmatic position that politics was inherently, well, okay, in some ways it is inherently evil, but the act of actually just casting a vote is not in and of itself evil. Because what if your vote, it was up to you to abolish slavery, your vote. You're going to tell me that you're going to say, no, on principle I won't cast that vote? How dare you? You know, I would cast that vote. So, you know, Rothbard would say that when you look at major advances that have been made in the cause of liberty, like, for example, the abolition of slavery or the repeal of the corn laws in England, which made food a lot cheaper for the average person, or even Andrew Jackson getting rid of the Second Bank of the United States, those things did not occur simply because a bunch of people became voluntarists and the system collapsed. It was political action that ended slavery. It was political action that ended the corn laws, and it was political action that got rid of the Second Bank of the United States. It wasn't that people just said, well, we just all will agree not to transact with that bank, and that will bring it down. Maybe that could work, but the point is that although politics 99.99% of the time leads to horrendous outcomes, you can't say with apodictic certainty that it must lead to that, because as I say, there are key historical episodes to the contrary. So I sort of feel like it's a division of labor thing. We have some people mm-hmm. who just can't help themselves. They just have got to be involved in politics, and there's no way you can persuade them otherwise. So let them do that. If that's an arena where they can spread some ideas, that's okay with me, because there are some people who are never going to think about abstract political, you know, philosophy ever. All they're ever going to pay attention to is a political speech that they see on TV. That is the only way they can ever be reached. So maybe that's the way those people get reached. I'm okay with that.
And how do you feel about the Free State Project?
I'm all in favor. I mean, I don't know much about it other than I know what their mission is. I mean, I guess that really is what what it's all about.
Just get people yeah, go, with Liberty up there.
Yeah, go. Yeah, just go up there. So I think that's a good idea. Unfortunately, the jerks who've screwed up Massachusetts, but have no idea why Massachusetts is screwed up. They don't realize they did it.
Mitt Romney knows.
Well, sure. But he's staying, he's at least having the decency to stay put in Massachusetts. But the Massachusettsians who screwed up their own state and now are saying, man, it's not even livable here anymore. Let's move to New Hampshire. We'll screw up that state too. I'm afraid they're moving faster than the free staters.
It's like a race.
Yeah, so you guys got to hurry up and get up there. You know, if only New Hampshire had some type of immigration policy, they could keep out these jerks.
Allie is moving up there at the end of the month.
I know. I gave you a bumper sticker and everything.
Yeah.
It's good.
That's exciting. Would you ever consider going to a pork fest?
I haven't ruled it out. I mean, Bob Murphy here, who was here.
Bob is here in our studio audience.
That's right. When I say here, I mean literally here. Bob gave me a very good report about it. I just wanted to find out from somebody who was actually there what really went on, what's it really like, and he just raved about it. So now I feel sort of good, and yeah, I haven't ruled
it out.
It's
not as scary as you may think.
Right. Well, I mean, it's tricky for me because it's not, people say, oh, you could bring your whole family. Well, for one thing, you know, I have four kids. I mean, you can't, they're really young, and it's, well, most of the people who say that have never traveled with young children.
Not that many.
It's very hard to do. And for me to be by myself, well, every time I go to some engagement, I'm leaving them behind, and I don't want to be an absentee father. So it's for me to do pro bono work at this point in my life is it's borderline irresponsible. I just can't do it. So
maybe when they're a little older.
If I just happen to be in the area for something else, maybe it could work out.
Okay. I was at your home and we played a spirited game of Pictionary.
Yeah.
And my team won. But I'm just
saying, you notice I'm not commenting on that. I'm still bitter and resentful, but yeah.
I knew there was something going on. We had, what, like five people on each team?
So it was a huge game.
It was huge.
Yeah.
But if you could have any four people on your Pictionary team.
Oh, gosh.
Who would it be?
Who would it be?
In history, fictional or real?
Oh, that's crazy. Well, I wouldn't want to cheat by picking an artist. No
I think
offense.
That's the idea.
Yeah, like I want to, I just want somebody with smarts who can't draw, but who can think of how to convey things anyway.
I will tell you a little thing about that. As an artist, it means nothing. When you have to draw that quickly, so it is mostly about spatial recognition. If you can draw a line next to a line, that's good. And quick thinking.
I'll tell you who they would be.
Oh, yeah,
they're
who
not
would
gonna
they
be not gonna be very interesting. Not gonna be like, I would have Abraham Lincoln as my Pictionary partner.
Who would want
be
that?
Yeah, boo. Listen to that. I was just trying to think of a historical figure.
This is the South.
First of all, I would be my wife, because a husband and wife have a kind of, you know, mental connection. So, you know, she can draw a line and I'll know she means Argentina or something. So that's good. Well, my father's deceased, unfortunately, but he and I made such a great Pictionary team. I had the word defect. So, you know, you're like stuck in the Soviet Union, you move to the U.S., you escape. How are you going to convey that in Pictionary? Well, you know, I draw a little U.S. flag, I draw a hammer and sickle, I draw a guy going over there. My father said, defect. Unbelievable, I can't believe you got that. It was just great.
Okay.
So it'd be that. Murphy over here, I'd pick him just because he's smart. And I think he's quick on his feet. I would, now, they all have to be sober, though. No drunk Pictionary. That'd be all different people. For drunk Pictionary, I want Ben Powell of Suffolk University. Because he can just drink and drink and drink and drink. And then he
and
could, like,
function.
Yeah, he could, like, build a tractor or something after that. So how many more have I got? I want Guido Holzman. I want Guido because I've never seen him play, but I think I have a feeling he has a certain awesomeness about him. And is that four?
That's four.
Okay,
you
and then Leah, of course I want you too.
Oh, thank you.
Yeah.
It would be only fair because we already beat you. So
right,
it would
so if
be...
you can't beat him, join him kind of thing?
And I would work very hard.
I appreciate that.
The cool thing about this team that you just created is, except for your father, we could actually create
you can make
this
it happen.
Team.
We
exactly.
could make it happen.
We, like
it's
we're
true.
Almost we're all here. I think we should do that and see, bring the Pictionary championships.
That's right. Find out if then we'll do another podcast and say, well, that was a bust.
How much longer are you in Auburn?
Not very. We're going to be leaving on Tuesday.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
So the end of the summer.
Yeah. So that's
well, next time you're in town,
yeah,
we'll do it. I think that would be fun.
Yeah.
I was going to ask what you thought about, in the Free State Project,
since you're saying that you don't know a whole lot about it, there is a rift between people who want to do the political stuff.
Oh, I bet there would be. Yeah, they want to get in the legislature and change things. Right,
and they want, and they
and
have
the Keene people are different.
The Keene people, which is where I'm going to Keene, and there are political people in Keene too. There's all types, but a lot of the civil disobedience and outside the system activism is going on in Keene. From what I've heard from a lot of the civil disobedience people, is that they're open to the political side of things, but the political people are like, you're making us look bad, man. You gotta stop
with
this.
Oh, I see. Yeah, yeah, yeah. Yeah, I just don't know enough about the details of what exactly is going on in Keene.
Do you think civil disobedience could ruin the political side of liberty?
No, I don't know. Again, I think it's up to each individual to decide, because I think people are morally justified in engaging in civil disobedience. So it's a matter of what you feel called or compelled to do, but you also have to make a strategic judgment. I mean, there are some things that it would be, you know, there's an order in which to do things. There are some things that it would be, I don't know off the top of my head, but I'm sure that would be counterproductive to start by going after. You have to think strategically before you do something like this, and you have to ask yourself, am I prepared to pay the penalty?
We wanted to mention your website.
Yeah, it's tomwoods.com, and okay. I mention it just because it's got, you know, like, there's no way to send me money through this website, so I'm not trolling for that, but it's just got a lot of free stuff. A lot of the stuff that I've been working on is archived there.
Okay, so anyone who liked this podcast and this interview can go there, get more information, and thank you for coming on the show.
You.
We really appreciate it.
Thanks
for
having me.
We're a new podcast, and so this is great.
Well, best of luck to you. Thanks
a
lot.
Thank you so much.
Okay, so that was it. We interviewed him. Tom Woods can retire.
Yep. Highlight of his career. It's all downhill from here. Might as well.
Yeah, and we're going to go buy ourselves a new BMW.
Yeah. I think we earned it.
I do too.
I mean, we've done five podcasts. Five. I think we deserve it.
That's exactly like writing a New York Times bestseller.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I'm glad that we can find the parallels between those.
He said no one reads New York Times bestsellers anyway, so.
Oh, well. Well.
And, I mean, we have, like, what, 5,000 listeners at this point?
5,000.
I might be exaggerating.
Just a little bit. All right, well, tune in next week. I am actually heading to Korea next week. I'm heading to Korea on Thursday. We didn't even talk about this, so I'm just going to say it briefly. This Thursday coming up, I'm flying to Korea. I'm actually going to be
there. That's why I'm going to start a collection for people to try to keep Leah in Auburn just until I leave for New Hampshire, because if she actually leaves on Friday, then I'm not going to get to see her until I come back to Auburn, or until she moves up to New Hampshire, or just comes to visit me at Porkfest next year.
Mm.
And that ain't right.
It's happening. I'm sorry.
That ain't right. And so, for those of you who agree with me and think that Leah should stay in Auburn for us to do a couple more podcasts face-to-face, shoulder-to-shoulder, then...
Yeah, our next podcast
Every little bit might help.
Our next podcast is going to be from afar. Well, especially because I'll be in
Korea. How much would it take, Leah, for you to stay in Auburn?
To not go to Korea?
Yeah.
$100,000.
$100,000? All right, shoot for the stars, y'all. Shoot for the stars. We need a donate button.
We do. I've already secured libertybellsradio.com, so we'll put a donate button on there. I just haven't built the site yet. And I don't know if we're going to be able to podcast from Korea, but we're going to try. I'm definitely bringing my laptop. I have my headphones, and I'll have to get in touch with Allie, and we'll have to try to do it. That would be pretty cool. I'm going to be there only for a week. I'm going there just to explore Korea.
I really hope that works out, because I'm going to have lots of questions. I think it'll be a good
podcast.
Yeah, a good podcast.
I agree. All right, guys. Well, that's the end of our podcast. I hope you enjoyed it, and we'll see you guys next time, or talk to you. Well, we're not even going to talk to you. We'll talk next time.
We'll talk next time.
Okay. See you guys later.